almost as though he were offering an excuse. "I do not know whether you have a family, Mr. Jones, but I certainly have." "No, I have no one," Jones admitted. "No one at all, unless you count a bit of tail here and there. You're right, Captain, I'm expendable. I'll have to sort this out some other way." He brooded a little while we watched him, then suddenly suggested, "I could stow away if you'd turn a blind eye." "In that case, I would have to hand you over to the police in Philadelphia. Does that suit you, Mr. Jones? I have an idea there are people in Philadelphia who want to ask you questions." "It's nothing serious. I owe a little money, that's all." "Off your own?" "On second thoughts, perhaps it wouldn't suit me all that well." I admire Jones's calm. He might have been a judge himself, sitting in chambers with two experts in a tricky chancery case. "The choice of action seems to be strictly limited," he summed the problem up. "Then I would suggest again the British Embassy," the captain said, in the chill voice of one who always knows the correct answer and expects no disagreement. "You're probably right. I didn't get on with the consul in Leopoldville very well, that's the truth. And they all come out of the same stable, career out of diplomatic bag. I'm afraid they'll have a report on me here, too. It's a problem, isn't it? You really would be bound to hand me over to the coppers in Philadelphia?"
"I'd be bound to."
"It's just as short as it's long, isn't it?" He turned to me. "What about some other embassy where there'd be no report?" "These things are governed by diplomatic rules," I said. "They couldn't claim a foreigner had the right of asylum. They'd be stuck with you for keeps as long as this government lasted."
Steps came rattling up the companionway. A hand knocked on the door. I saw Jones catch his breath. He wasn't nearly so calm as he tried to show.
"Come in."
The second officer entered. He looked at us without surprise, as though he expected to find strangers. He spoke to the captain in Dutch, and the captain asked him a question. He replied with his eye on Jones. The captain turned to us. As though he had at last abandoned the hope of Maigret for the night, he put his book down. He said,
"There's a police officer at the gangway with three men. They want to come on board."
Jones gave a deep, unhappy sigh. Perhaps he was watching Saib House and the 18th Hole and the Desert Island Bar disappearing forever. The captain gave an order in Dutch to the second officer, who left the cabin. He said,
"I must get dressed."
He balanced shyly on the edge of the bunk like a hausfrau, then heavily descended.
"You're letting them come on board?" Jones exclaimed. "Where's your pride? This is Dutch territory, isn't it?"
"Mr. Jones, if you will please go into the toilet and keep quiet, it will be easier for all of us."
I opened a door at the end of the bunk and pushed Jones through. He went reluctantly.
"I'm trapped here," he said, "like a rat," then altered the phrase quickly to "a rabbit, I mean," and gave me a frightened smile.
I set him firmly down like a child on the lavatory seat. The captain was pulling his trousers on and tucking in his nightshirt. He took a uniform jacket off a peg and put it on. The nightshirt was concealed by the collar.
"You're not going to let them search," I protested.
He had no time to reply or to put on his shoes and socks before the knock came on the door. I knew the police officer who entered. He was a real bastard, as bad as any of the Tonton Macoute, a man as big as Dr. Maggio, and one who wielded a terrific punch. Many broken jaws in Port-au-Prince testified to his strength. His mouth was full of gold teeth, probably not his own. He carried them as an Indian brave used to carry scalps. He looked at us both with insolence, while the second officer, a pimply youth, hovered nervously behind.
he said to me, the words like an insult. I know you. The little thin captain looked very vulnerable in his bare feet, but he replied with spirit, I don't know you. What are you doing on board at this hour? The policeman said to me. The captain said in French to the second officer, so that his meaning was clear to everyone, I thought I told you he was to leave his gun behind.
He refused, sir. He pushed me on one side.
Refused? Pushed?
The captain drew himself up and almost reached the negro's shoulder.
I invited you on board, but only on conditions. I am the only man allowed to carry arms on this ship. You are not in Haiti now.
That phrase, spoken with conviction, really disconcerted the officer. It was like a magic spell. He felt unsafe. He looked around at all of us. He looked around the cabin. Pas à Haiti, he exclaimed, and I suppose he saw only the unfamiliar, a framed certificate on the wall for saving life at sea, a photograph of a grim white woman with iron-grey waves in her hair, a stone bottle of something called balls, a photograph of the Amsterdam canals, ice-bound in winter. He repeated distractedly,
Pas à Haiti?
Vous êtes en Hollande, the captain said with a masterly laugh as he held out his hand. Give me your revolver.
I am under orders, the bully said miserably. I am doing my duty. My officer will return it to you when you leave the ship. But I am looking for a criminal. Not in my ship. He came here in your ship. I am not responsible for that. Now give me your revolver. I must search. You can search all you like on shore, but not here. Here I am responsible for law and order. Unless you give me your revolver, I shall call the crew to disarm you, and afterwards I will have you pitched into the harbor.
The man was beaten. His eye was drawn to the disapproving face of the captain's wife as he unbuttoned his holster and handed over his gun. The captain put it in her charge.
Now, he said, I am prepared to answer any reasonable questions. What is it you want to know? We want to know if you have a criminal on board. You know him, a man called Jones.
Here is a passenger list, if you can read.
His name will not be on it.
I have been captain on this line for 10 years. I stick to the letter of the law. I will never carry a passenger who is not on that list, nor a passenger without an exit visa.
Has he an exit visa?
No.
Then I can promise you, Lieutenant, that he will never be a passenger in the ship.
The sound of his rank seemed to mollify the police officer a little.
He may be hidden, he said, without your knowledge. In the morning before sailing, I will have the ship searched, and if he is found, I shall put him ashore.
The man hesitated.
If he is not here, he said, he must have gone to the British Embassy.
It would be a more natural place, the captain said, than the Royal Netherlands Steamship Company.
He handed the revolver to the second officer.
You will give it to him, he said, at the foot of the gangway.
He turned his back and left the officer's black hand floating in midair like a catfish in an aquarium. We waited in silence until the second officer returned and told the captain that the lieutenant had driven away with his men. Then I let Jones out of the lavatory. He was effusively grateful.
You were superb, Captain, he said.
The captain regarded him with dislike and contempt. He said,
I told him only the truth. If I had discovered you stowing away, I would have put you on shore. I am glad I did not have to lie. I would have found it hard to forgive myself or you.
Please leave my ship as soon as it is safe.
He removed his jacket. He pulled his white nightshirt out of his trousers so that he could remove them with modesty. We went away. Outside, I leant over the rail and looked at the policeman who had returned to the foot of the gangway. He was last night's policeman, and there was no sign of the lieutenant or his men. I said, "It's too late now for the British Embassy. It will be well guarded by this time."
"What do we do, then?"
"God knows, but we've got to leave the boat. If we are still here in the morning, the captain will be as good as his word."
The purser, who woke quite cheerfully from his sleep, he was lying flat on his back when we entered, with a lubricious smile on his face, saved the situation. He said,
"There is no difficulty about Mr. Brown leaving. The policeman knows him already. But there is only one solution for Mr. Jones. He must leave as a woman."
"But the clothes?" I asked.
"There is an acting box here for the ship's parties. We have the dress of a Spanish senorita and a peasant costume from Volendam."
Jones said piteously,
"But my moustache."
"You must shave it off."
Neither the Spanish costume, which was designed for a flamenco dancer, nor the elaborate headgear of the Dutch peasant was inconspicuous. We tried our best to make an unobtrusive mixture of the two, jettisoning the Volendam headgear and the wooden sabots of the one and the mantilla of the other, as well as a great many underskirts in both cases. Meanwhile, Jones gloomily and painfully shaved. There was no hot water. Oddly enough, he looked more reliable without his moustache. It was as though before he had been wearing an incorrect uniform. Now I could almost believe in his military career. Odder still, when once the great sacrifice had been made, he entered with a kind of expert enthusiasm into the spirit of the charade.
"You have no rouge or lipstick?" he asked the purser. But the purser had none, and Jones had to make do for cosmetics with a stick of Remington pre-shave powder. It gave him, above the black Volendam skirt and the spangled Spanish blouse, a look of lurid pallor.
"At the foot of the gangway," he told the purser, "you must kiss me. It will help to hide my face."
"Why not kiss Mr. Brown?" the purser asked.
"He's taking me home. It wouldn't be natural. You have to imagine that we've passed quite an evening together, all three of us."
"What kind of an evening?"
"An evening of riotous abandonment," Jones said.
"Can you manage your skirt?" I asked.
"Of course, old man," he added mysteriously. "This is not the first time. Under very different circumstances, of course."
He went down the gangway on my arm. The skirts were so long that he had to gather them in one hand, like a Victorian lady picking her way across a muddy street. The ship's sentry stared at us agape. He hadn't known there was a woman aboard, and such a woman, too. Jones, as he passed the sentry, gave him an appraising and provocative glance from his brown eyes. I noticed how fine and bold they looked now below his shawl. They had been killed by the moustache. At the foot of the gangway, he embraced the purser and left him smudged on both cheeks with pre-shave powder. The policeman watched us with dulled curiosity. It was obvious that Jones was not the first woman to leave the boat in the early hours, and he could hardly have appealed to any man acquainted with the girls at Mère Catherine's. We walked slowly, arm in arm, to the place where I had left my car.
"You're holding your skirt too high," I warned him.
"I was never a modest woman, old man."
"I mean the flick can see your shoes."
"Not in the dark."
I would never have believed our escape could prove so easy. No footsteps followed us. The car was there, unwatched. Peace and Columbus reigned over the night. I sat and thought while Jones arranged his skirts. He said,
"I played Boadicea once, in a skit, to amuse the fellows. I had royalty in the audience."
"Royalty?"
"Lord Mountbatten.
Those were the days. Would you mind lifting your left leg? My skirt's caught.
Where do we go from here? I said.
Search me. The man I wrote the introduction to, he's dossing down in the Venezuelan embassy. It's the most heavily guarded of the lot. They have half the general staff there. I'd be quite satisfied with something more modest. Perhaps you wouldn't be taken in. You aren't exactly a political refugee, are you? Doesn't deceiving Papa Doc count as resistance? Perhaps you wouldn't be welcome as a permanent guest. Have you thought of that? They'd hardly push me out, would they, if I were once safely in? I think one or two of them might even do that.
I started the engine, and we began to drive slowly back into the town. I didn't wish to give the impression of flight. I watched before every turn for the light of another car, but Port-au-Prince was as empty as a cemetery.
Where are you taking me?
To the only place I can think of. The ambassador's away. I felt relief as we mounted the hill. There would be no roadblock on this side of the familiar turning. At the gates, a policeman looked briefly into the car. He knew my face, and Jones passed easily enough for a woman when the dashboard light was out. Obviously, there had not yet been a general alarm. Jones was only a criminal. He was not a patriot. They had probably worn the roadblocks and put some tonton macoute around the British Embassy. With the Medea covered, and probably my hotel too, they must think they had him cornered. I told Jones to stay in the car, and I rang the bell. Somebody was awake, for I could see a light burning in a window on the ground floor. Yet I had to ring twice, and I waited with impatience as heavy steps came from a long way back inside, ponderous, unhurried. A dog yapped and whined. I was puzzled by the noise, for I had never seen a dog in the house. Then a voice, I supposed that it was the night porter's, asked who was there. I said, "I want Senora Pineda. Tell her it is Monsieur Brown. Something urgent." The door was unlocked, unbolted, and then unchained, but the man who threw it open was not the porter. The ambassador himself stood there, peering myopically. He was in his shirt sleeves, and he wore no tie. I had never before seen him less than immaculate. Beside him, on guard, was a horrible miniature dog, all long grey hair, the shape of a centipede. "You want my wife?" he said. "She is asleep." Seeing his tired and wounded eyes, I thought, "He knows. He knows everything." "Do you want me to wake her?" he asked. "Is it so urgent? She is with my son. They are both asleep." I said, lamely and ambiguously, "I didn't know that you had returned." "I came in on tonight's plane." He put up his hand to where his tie should have been. "There's a lot of work waiting for me to do. Papers to be read, you know how it is." It was as though he were apologizing to me and proffering me humbly his passport. Nationality, human being. Special peculiarities, cuckold. I said with a sense of shame, "No, please don't wake her. It was really you I wanted to see." "Me?" I thought for a moment he would give way to a panic impulse, that he would retreat inside and close the door. Perhaps he believed I was about to tell him what he was afraid to hear. "Won't it wait until the morning?" he implored me. "So late, so much to do." He felt for a cigar case which wasn't there. I think he half intended to press a bundle of cigars into my hands, as another might have pressed money, to persuade me to go. But there weren't any cigars. He said in miserable surrender, "Come in, then, if you must." I said, "The dog doesn't like me." "Don Juan?" He rapped out an order to the miserable creature, which began to lick his shoe. I said, "I have a companion," and signaled to Jones.
The ambassador watched with despairing incredulity the appearance of Jones. He must still have thought that I intended to confess all, and perhaps demand the breakup of his marriage, and what part, he probably demanded, could she play in the affair? Was she a witness, a nurse to look after Angel, a substitute wife? In a nightmare, anything, however cruel or grotesque, is possible, and this to him was certainly a nightmare. First out of the car came the heavy rubber-soled shoes, a pair of socks striped in scarlet and black, like a school tie worn in the wrong place, then fold after fold of blue-black skirt, and at last the head and shoulders wrapped in a scarf, the Remington white face, and the provocative brown eyes. Jones shook himself like a sparrow after a dust bath, and advanced rapidly to join us. "This is Mr. Jones," I said. "Major Jones," he corrected me. "I'm glad to meet you, Your Excellency." "He wants asylum here. The Tonton Macoute are after him. There's not a hope of getting him into the British Embassy. It's too well guarded. I thought perhaps, although he is not a South American, he is in extreme danger." A look of enormous relief spread over the ambassador's face while I spoke. This was politics. This he could deal with. This was every day. "Come in, Major Jones, come in. You are very welcome. My house is at your disposition. I will wake my wife at once. One of my rooms shall be prepared." In his relief, he threw his possessive articles around like confetti. Then he closed, locked, bolted, and chained the door, and absent-mindedly offered his arm to Jones to escort him into the house. Jones took it, and moved magnificently across the hall like a Victorian matron. The horrible grey dog swept the ground beside him with his matted hair smelling at the fringe of Jones's skirt. "Louise!" Martha stood on the landing and looked down at us with sleepy amazement. "My dear," the ambassador said, "let me introduce you. This is Mr. Jones, our first refugee." "Mr. Jones?" "Major Jones," Jones corrected them both, lifting the scarf from his head as though it were a hat. Martha leant over the banisters and laughed. She laughed till her eyes filled with tears. I could see her breasts through her nightdress, and even the shadow of her hair, and so, I thought, could Jones. He smiled up at her and said, "In the women's army, of course." And I remembered the girl called Tintin at Mère Catherine's, who, when I asked her why she liked him, had said to me, "He made me laugh." 2. There was not much of the night left for me in which to sleep. As I returned to the Trianon, the same police officer who had boarded the Medea stopped me at the entrance to the drive and demanded where I had been. "You know that as well as I do," I said, and he searched my car very thoroughly in revenge. A stupid man. I rummaged in the bar for a drink, but the ice containers had been left dry, and there was only a bottle of 7-Up remaining on the shelves. I laced it heavily with rum and sat out on the veranda to wait for the sun to rise. The mosquitoes had long ceased to trouble me. I was stale and tainted meat. The hotel behind me seemed emptier than it had ever done before. I missed the limping Joseph as I might have missed a familiar wound, for perhaps unconsciously I had ached a little with him in his halting progress from the bar to the veranda and up and down the stairs. His footstep was at least one I could easily recognize, and I wondered in what waste of mountain it was sounding now, or whether he was dead already among the stony knobs of Hades' spine. It seemed to me the only sound to which I had ever had the time to become accustomed. I was filled with self-pity, sweet like the Bourbon biscuits of Angel. Could I yet separate even the sound of Martha's footsteps, I asked myself, from another woman's? I doubted it, and certainly I had never learnt to know my mother's before she left me behind with the fathers of the visitation. And my real father?
He had deposited not so much as one childish memory. Presumably he was dead, but I wasn't sure. This was a century in which old men lived beyond their time. But I felt no genuine curiosity about him, nor had I any wish to seek him out or find his tombstone, which was possibly, but not certainly, marked with the name Brown. Yet my lack of curiosity was a hollow where a hollow should not have been. I had not plugged the hollow with a substitute, as a dentist puts in a temporary filling. No priest had come to represent a father to me, and no region of the earth had taken the place of home. I was a citizen of Monaco, that was all. The palms had begun to detach themselves from the anonymous darkness. They reminded me of the palms outside the casino on that blue artificial coast where even the sand was an importation. A faint breeze stirred the long leaves, which were serrated like the keyboard of a piano. The keys were depressed two or three at a time, as though by an invisible player. Why was I here? I was here because of a picture postcard from my mother, which could easily have gone astray. No odds at any casino could have been higher than that. There are those who belong by their birth inextricably to a country, who even when they leave it feel the tie. And there are those who belong to a province, a county, a village. But I could feel no link at all with the 100 or so square kilometers around the gardens and boulevards of Monte Carlo, a city of transients. I felt a greater tie here, in the shabby land of terror, chosen for me by chance. The first colors touched the garden, deep green and then deep red. Transience was my pigmentation. My roots would never go deep enough anywhere to make me a home or make me secure with love.
Chapter 2. 1. There were no longer any guests in the hotel. When the Smiths departed, the cook, who had made my kitchen famous with his soufflés, gave up all hope and moved to the Venezuelan embassy, where at least there were a few refugees to feed. For my meals I would boil myself an egg, or open a tin, or share the Haitian food with my last remaining maid and the gardener. Or sometimes I would have a meal with the Pinedos, not often, for the presence of Jones irritated me. Angel now went to a school organized by the Spanish ambassador's wife, and in the afternoons Martha would drive quite openly up the Trianon Drive and leave her car in my garage. The fear of discovery had left her, or perhaps a complacent husband now gave us a limited freedom. In my bedroom we would pass the hours making love or talking, and only too often quarrelling. We even quarrelled about the ambassador's dog. "It gives me the creeps," I said, "like a rat wearing a wool shawl or a long centipede. What induced him to buy it?"
"I suppose he wanted company," she said.
"He has you."
"You know how little he has of me."
"Have I got to feel sorry for him, too?"
"It wouldn't do any of us harm," she said, "to feel sorry for someone."
She was more astute than I at seeing the distant cloud of a quarrel when it was still no bigger than a man's hand, and she would usually take the right avoiding action, for when an embrace was over, the quarrel was usually over too, for that occasion at least. Once she spoke of my mother and their friendship.
"Strange, wasn't it? My father was a war criminal, and she was a heroine of the resistance."
"You really think she was?"
"Yes."
"I found a medal in a piggy bank, but I thought it might be the memento of a love affair. There was a holy medal in the pig, too, but that meant nothing. She was certainly not a pious woman. When she left me with the Jesuits, it was for convenience only. They could afford an unpaid bill."
"You were with the Jesuits?"
"Yes."
"I remember now. I used to think you were nothing."
"I am nothing."
"Yes, but a Protestant nothing, not a Catholic nothing. I am a Protestant nothing."
I had a sense of colored balls flying in the air, a different color for every faith, or even every lack of faith. There was an existentialist ball, a logical positivist ball.
I even thought you might be a communist, nothing.
It was gay. It was fun, so long as with great agility one patted the balls around. It was only when a ball fell to the ground one had the sense of an impersonal wound, like a dog dead on an arterial road.
Dr. Maggio's a communist, she said.
I suppose so. I envy him. He's lucky to believe. I left all such absolutes behind me in the chapel of the Visitation. Do you know, they even thought once that I had a vocation.
Perhaps you are a prêtre manqué.
Me? You are laughing at me. Put your hand here. This has no theology. I mocked myself while I made love. I flung myself into pleasure like a suicide onto a pavement. What made us, after that short furious encounter, talk of Jones again? I am confusing together in memory many afternoons, many love-makings, many discussions, many quarrels. All of them a curtain-raiser for the final quarrel of all. For example, there was the afternoon when she left early, and to my inquiry why she was going, Angel would not be back from school for a long time yet, she replied, I promised Jones that he could teach me gin rummy. It was only 10 days after I had deposited Jones under her roof, and when she told me that, I felt the premonition of jealousy like the first shiver which announces a fever.
It must be an exciting game. You prefer it to making love?
Darling, we've made love all we can. I don't want to disappoint him. He's a good guest. Angel likes him. He plays a lot with Angel.
And an afternoon much later, the quarrel began in another way. She asked me suddenly, it was the first sentence she spoke after our bodies separated, what the word midge meant.
A kind of small mosquito? Why?
Jones always calls the dog Midge, and he answers to the name. His real name is Don Juan, but he's never learnt that.
I suppose you are going to tell me the dog likes Jones, too.
Oh, but he does. Better than he likes Luis. Luis always feeds him. He won't even allow Angel to do that, and yet Jones has only to call Midge.
What does Jones call you?
How do you mean?
You go to him when he calls. You leave early to play gin rummy.
That was 3 weeks ago. I've never done it again.
We spend half our time now talking about that damned crook.
You brought the damned crook to our house.
I didn't know he was going to become such a friend of the family.
Darling, he makes us laugh, that's all.
She couldn't have chosen an explanation which worried me more.
There isn't much to laugh about here.
Here?
You're twisting every word. I don't mean here in bed. I mean here in Port-au-Prince.
Two different languages cause misunderstanding. I should have taken lessons in German. Does Jones speak German?
Not even Louise does. Darling, when you want me, I'm a woman. But when I hurt you, I'm always a German. What a pity Monaco never had a period of power.
It had, but the English beat the prince's fleet in the Channel, like the Luftwaffe.
I was 10 years old when you beat the Luftwaffe.
I did no beating. I sat in an office translating propaganda against Vichy into French.
Jones had a more interesting war.
Oh, yes?
Was it innocence which caused her so often to introduce his name, or did she feel a compulsion to have it on her tongue?
He was in Burma, she said, fighting the Japs.
He's told you that?
He's very interesting when he talks about guerrilla fighting.
The resistance could have done with him here, but he preferred the government to the resistance.
But he's seen through the government now.
Or have they seen through him? Did he tell you about the lost platoon?
Yes.
And how he has a nose for water?
Yes. Sometimes I wonder that he didn't end up at least a brigadier.
Darling, what's the matter?
Othello charmed Desdemona with his stories of adventure. It's an old technique. I ought to tell you how I was hounded by the people. It might win your sympathy.
What people?
Never mind.
A change of subject in an embassy is always something. The first secretary is an authority on turtles. It was interesting for a while in a natural history way, but it palled all the same. And the second secretary is an admirer of Cervantes, but not of Don Quixote, which he says was a bid for easy popularity.
I suppose the Burmese war, too, will become stale in time.
At least he doesn't repeat himself yet like the others.
Has he told you the history of his cocktail case?
Yes, indeed he has. Darling, you underrate him. He's a very generous man. You know how our shaker leaks, so he gave Luis his, in spite of all the memories attached. It's a very good one. It came from Asprey's in London. He said it was the only thing he had with which to return our hospitality. We said we'd borrow it. And do you know what he did? He gave money to one of the servants to take it to Hermites and have it inscribed. So there it is. We can't give it back.
Such a quaint inscription. To Luis and Martha from their grateful guest, Jones. Like that. No Christian name, no initials, like a French actor.
And your first name.
And Luis's. Darling, it's time I left.
What a long time we've spent, haven't we, talking about Jones?
I expect we'll spend a lot more. Papa Doc won't give him a safe conduct, not even as far as the British Embassy. The government makes a formal protest every week. They claim he's a common criminal, but of course that's nonsense. He was ready to work with them, but then his eyes were opened by young Filippo.
Is that what he claims?
He tried to sabotage a supply of arms to the Tonton Macoute.
An ingenious story.
So that really does make him a political refugee.
He lives on his wits, that's all.
Don't we all, to some extent?
How quickly you leap to his defense.
Suddenly I had a grotesque vision of the two of them in bed, Martha, naked as she was now, and Jones still in his female finery, his face yellow with pre-shave powder, lifting his great black velvet skirt above his thighs.
Darling, what is it now?
It's so stupid. To think that I brought the little crook to live with you, and now there he stays, for life, perhaps, or until someone can get near enough to Papa Doc with a silver bullet. How long has Minzenti stayed in the American Embassy in Budapest? 12 years? Jones sees you all day long.
Not in your way.
Oh, Jones has to have his periodic woman, I know that. I've seen him in action. And as for me, I can only see you for dinner, or cocktail parties of the second order.
You're not at dinner now.
He's climbed the wall. He's in the garden itself.
You should have been a novelist, she said. Then we would all have been your characters. We couldn't say to you, we are not like that at all. We couldn't answer back. Darling, don't you see you are inventing us?
I'm glad at least I've invented this bed.
We can't even talk to you, can we? You won't listen if what we say is out of character, the character you've given us.
What character? You're a woman I love, that's all.
Oh, yes, I'm classified. A woman you love.
She got out of bed and began very rapidly to dress. She swore, mad, when a suspender failed to snap. She got her dress twisted over her head and had to start again. She was like someone escaping from a fire. She couldn't find the second stocking.
I said, I'm going to get your guest away soon, somehow.
I don't mind if you do or not, as long as he's safe.
Angel will miss him, though.
Yes.
And Midge.
Yes.
And Louise.
He amuses Louise.
And you?
She thrust her feet into her shoes and didn't answer.
We'll have peace together when he's gone. You won't be torn in two between us then.
She looked at me a moment as though I had said something that shocked her. Then she came up to the bed and took my hand, as though I were a child who didn't understand the meaning of his words, but who must be warned all the same not to repeat them. She said,
"My darling, be careful. Don't you understand? To you, nothing exists except in your own thoughts. Not me, not Jones. We're what you choose to make us. You're a Berkeleyan. My God, what a Berkeleyan! You've turned poor Jones into a seducer and me into a wanton mistress. You can't even believe in your mother's mettle, can you? You've written her a different part. My dear, try to believe we exist when you aren't there. We're independent of you. None of us is like you fancy we are. Perhaps it wouldn't matter much if your thoughts were not so dark, always so dark." I tried to kiss her mood away, but she turned quickly, and standing at the door, said to the empty passage, "It's a dark brown world you live in. I'm sorry for you, as I'm sorry for my father."
I lay in bed a long while and wondered what I could possibly have in common with a war criminal responsible for so many unidentified deaths.
2. The headlights swept up between the palms and settled like a yellow moth over my face. I could see nothing clearly when they were switched off, only something large and black approaching the veranda. I had suffered one beating up. I didn't want another. I shouted, "Joseph!" But, of course, Joseph wasn't there. I had been sleeping over my glass of rum, and I had forgotten.
"Is Joseph back?"
It was a relief to hear Dr. Maggio's voice. He came slowly, with his inexplicable dignity, up the broken veranda steps, as though they were the marble steps of the Senate House, and he was a senator from the Outer Empire, granted Roman citizenship. "I was asleep. I wasn't thinking. Can I get you something, Doctor? I'm my own cook now, but I can easily beat you up an omelette."
"No, I'm not hungry. May I put my car away in your garage in case anyone comes?"
"No one ever comes here at night."
"You never know, in case."
When he returned, I repeated my offer of food, but he would take nothing.
"I wanted company, that's all."
He chose a hard, straight chair to sit in.
"I used often to come and see your mother here in the happier days. I find it lonely now after the sun sets."
The lightning had begun, and the nightly deluge would soon descend. I drew my chair a little further into the shelter of the veranda.
"Do you see nothing of your colleagues?" I asked. "What colleagues? Oh, there are a few old men left like myself behind their locked doors. In the last 10 years, 3/4 of the doctors who graduated here preferred to go elsewhere as soon as they could buy an exit permit. Here one buys an exit permit, not a practice. If you want to consult a Haitian doctor, better go to Ghana."
He lapsed into silence. It was company, not conversation, that he needed. The rain began to fall, tingling in the swimming pool, which was empty again. The night was so dark I couldn't see Dr. Maggio's face, only the tips of his fingers laid out on the arms of his chair, like carved wood.
"The other night," Dr. Maggio said, "I had an absurd dream. The telephone sounded. Think of that, the telephone. How many years is it since I heard a telephone? I was summoned to the General Hospital for a casualty. When I arrived, I saw with satisfaction how clean the ward was. The nurses, too, were young and spotless. Of course, you will find they have all left for Africa as well. My colleague advanced to meet me, a young man in whom I had great hopes. He is fulfilling them now in Brazzaville. He told me that the opposition candidate, how old-fashioned even the words sound today, had been attacked by rowdies at a political meeting. There were complications. His left eye was in danger. I began to examine the eye, but it turned out not to be the eye at all, but the cheek, which was cut open to the bone. My colleague returned. He said, "The chief of police is on the telephone. The assailants have been arrested. The president is anxious to know the result of your examination. The president's wife has sent these flowers." Dr. Maggio began to laugh softly in the dark. "Even at the best," he said, "even under President Estime, it was never like that. Freud's wish-fulfillment dreams are usually not so obvious." "Not a very Marxist dream, Dr. Maggio, with an opposition candidate." "Perhaps the Marxist dream of a far, far future, when the state has withered away and there are only local elections, in the parish of Haiti. When I came to your house, I was surprised to find Das Kapital openly on a shelf. Is that safe?"
"I told you once before, Papa Doc makes a distinction between philosophy and propaganda. He wants to keep his window open towards the east until the Americans give arms to him again."
"They'll never do that."
"I will make you a bet of 10-1 that in a matter of months relations are healed and the American ambassador returns. You forget, Papa Doc is a bulwark against communism. There will be no Cuba and no Bay of Pigs here. Of course, there are other reasons. Papa Doc's lobbyist in Washington is the lobbyist for certain American-owned mills. They grind gray flour for the people out of imported surplus wheat. It is astonishing how much money can be made out of the poorest of the poor with a little ingenuity. And then there's the great beef racket. The poor here can eat meat no more than they can eat cake, so I suppose they don't suffer when all the beef that exists goes to the American market. It doesn't matter to the importers that there are no standards here of cattle raising. It goes into tins for underdeveloped countries, paid for by American aid, of course. It wouldn't affect the Americans if this trade ceased, but it would affect the particular Washington politician who receives 1 cent for every pound exported."
"Do you despair of any future?"
"No, I don't despair. I don't believe in despair. But our problems won't be solved by the Marines. We have had experience of the Marines. I'm not sure I wouldn't fight for Papa Doc if the Marines came. At least he's Haitian. No, the job has to be done with our own hands. We are an evil slum floating a few miles from Florida, and no American will help us with arms or money or counsel. We learned a few years back what their counsel meant. There was a resistance group here who were in touch with a sympathizer in the American embassy. They were promised all kinds of moral support, but the information went straight back to the CIA, and from the CIA by a very direct route to Papa Doc. You can imagine what happened to the group. The State Department didn't want any disturbance in the Caribbean."
"And the communists?"
"We are better organized and more discreet than the others, but if we ever tried to take over, you can be certain the Marines would land and Papa Doc would remain in power. In Washington, we seem a very stable country, not suitable for tourists. But tourists are a nuisance anyway. Sometimes they see too much and write to their senators. Your Mr. Smith was very disturbed by the executions in the cemetery."
By the way, Hamid has disappeared.
What happened?
I hope he's gone into hiding, but his car was found abandoned near the port. He has a lot of American friends, but he is not an American citizen. He is a Haitian. You can do what you like with Haitians. Trujillo murdered 20,000 of us in time of peace on the River Massacre, peasants who had come to his country for cane cutting, men, women, and children. But do you imagine there was one protest from Washington? He lived nearly 20 years afterwards, fat on American aid.
What do you hope for, Dr. Maggio?
Perhaps a palace revolution. Papa Doc never stirs outside. You can only reach him in the palace. And then, before Fat Gracia settles in his place, a purge by the people.
No hope from the rebels?
Poor souls, they don't know how to fight. They go waving their rifles, if they've got them, at a fortified post. They may be heroes, but they have to learn to live and not to die. Do you think Filippo knows the first thing about guerrilla fighting? And your poor lame Joseph? They need someone of experience, and then perhaps in a year or two. We are as brave as the Cubans, but the terrain is very cruel. We have destroyed our forests. You have to live in caves and sleep on stones, and there's the question of water.
Like a comment on his pessimism, the deluge fell. We couldn't even hear ourselves speak. The lights of the town were blotted out. I went into the bar and brought out 2 glasses of rum and set them between the doctor and myself. I had to guide his hand to his glass. We sat in silence till the worst of the storm was over.
"You're an odd man," Dr. Maggio said at last.
"Why odd?"
You listen to me as though I were an old man speaking of a distant past. You seem so indifferent, and yet you live here.
I was born in Monaco, I said. That is almost the same as being a citizen of nowhere.
If your mother had lived to see these days, she would not have been so indifferent. She might well be up in the mountains now.
Uselessly?
Oh, yes, uselessly, of course.
With her lover?
He certainly would never have let her go alone.
Perhaps I take after my father.
Who was he?
I've no idea. Like my country of birth, he has no face. The rain diminished. I could hear the separate sound of the drops now on the trees, on the bushes, on the hard cement of the bathing pool. I said, I take things as they come. That's what most of the world does, surely. One has to live.
What do you want out of life, Brown? I know how your mother would have answered.
How?
She would have laughed at me for not knowing the answer. Fun. But fun, for her, included almost everything, even death.
Dr. Maggio got up and stood at the edge of the veranda.
I thought I heard something. Imagination. The nights make us all nervy. I really loved your mother, Brown.
And her lover. What did you make of him?
He made her happy. What do you want, Brown?
I want to run this hotel. I want to see it as it used to be, before Papa Doc came. Joseph busy behind the bar, girls in the bathing pool, cars coming up the drive, all the stupid noises of enjoyment, icing glasses, laughter in the bushes, and, of course, oh yes, the rustle of dollar notes.
And then?
Oh, I suppose a body to love, as my mother had.
And after that?
God knows. Isn't that enough for what's left of a lifetime? I'm nearly 60 now.
Your mother was a Catholic.
Not much of one.
I retain a faith, even if it's only the truth of certain economic laws,
But you've lost yours.
Have I? Perhaps I never had one. Anyway, it's a limitation to believe, isn't it? We sat in silence for a while with empty glasses. Then Dr. Maggio said,
I had a message from Filippo. He's in the mountains behind Lake Gay, but he plans to move north. He has a dozen men with him, including Joseph. I hope the others aren't cripples. Two lame men are enough. He wants to join with the guerrillas near the Dominican border. There are said to be 30 men there.
What an army! 42 men.
Castro had 12. But you can't tell me that Filippo is a Castro. He thinks he can establish a base near the frontier for training. Papa Doc has chased the peasants away for a depth of 10 kilometers, so there is a possibility of secrecy, if not of recruits. He needs Jones.
Why Jones?
He has a great belief in Jones. He would do much better to find himself a Bren. Training is more important than weapons at the start. You can always take weapons from the dead, but first you have to learn how to kill.
How do you know all this, Dr. Maggio?
At times they have to trust even one of us.
One of you?
A communist.
It's a wonder you survive.
If there were no communists, most of our names are on the CIA list, Papa Doc would cease to be a bulwark of the free world. There may be another reason, too. I'm a good doctor. The day might arrive. He's not immune.
If only you could convert your stethoscope into something fatal.
Yes, I've thought of that, but he will probably outlive me.
French medicine is fond of suppositories and piqûres.
They would be tested first by someone of no importance.
And you really think that Jones? He's only good to make a woman laugh.
He had the right experience in Burma. The Japanese were cleverer than the Tonton Macoute.
Oh, yes, he boasts about that time. I hear he holds them spellbound in the embassy. He sings for his supper.
He can't want to spend his whole life in the embassy.
He doesn't want to die on the doorstep either.
There are always means of evasion.
He'd never risk it.
He was risking a lot when he tried to swindle Papa Doc. Don't underrate him, just because he boasts a lot. And you can trap a man who boasts. You can call his bluff.
Oh, don't mistake me, Dr. Maggio. I want him out of the embassy every bit as much as Filippo can.
And yet you put him there.
I didn't realize.
What?
Oh, that's quite a different matter. I'd do anything. Somebody was walking up the drive. The footsteps squealed on the wet leaves and the scraps of old coconut shells. We both sat silent, waiting. In Port-au-Prince, nobody walked at night. I wondered whether Dr. Maggio carried a gun, but it wasn't in his character. Somebody halted at the edge of the trees where the drive turned. A voice called,
Mr. Brown?
Yes.
Have you no light?
Who is it?
Petit Pierre.
I was suddenly aware that Dr. Maggio was no longer with me. It was extraordinary how silently the big man could move when he chose.
I'll fetch one, I called. I'm alone.
I felt my way back into the bar. I knew where I would find a torch. When I turned it on, I saw that the door into the kitchen quarters was open. I came back with a lamp, and Petit Pierre climbed the steps. It was weeks since I had seen those sharp, ambiguous features. His jacket was sopping wet, and he hung it on the back of a chair. I helped him to a glass of rum and awaited an explanation. It was unusual to see him after sundown.
My car broke down, he said. I waited until the worst rain was over. The lights are late tonight in coming on.
I said mechanically, It was part of the small talk of Port-au-Prince. "Did they search you at the block?"
"Not in this rain," he said. "There are no roadblocks when it rains. You can't expect a militia man to work in a storm."
"It's a long time since I've seen you, Petit Pierre."
"I've been very busy."
"Surely there's not much for your gossip column?" He giggled in the dark.
"There's always something, Mr. Brown. Today is a great day in the history of Petit Pierre."
"Don't tell me you've got married."
"No, no, no. Guess again."
"You've inherited a fortune."
"A fortune in Port-au-Prince? Oh, no. Mr. Brown, today I have installed a hi-fi stereo."
"Congratulations. Does it work?"
"I haven't bought any discs yet, so I cannot tell. I have ordered